Hey gamers, this is Liz Davidson from Beyond Solitaire, and I'm once again taking you beyond the board, this time with special guest Tom Russell.
Hello.
And why don't you give us the elevator pitch about who you are?
I am a game designer. I co-own a game publishing company, Hollenspiel, with my wife, Mary, and we publish what we like to call weird games and war games. So that is what we do.
Weird games and war games. I like it. So we'll return to that. But I just feel it needs to be on record that in addition to a game designer and publisher, you are also a fake Latinist. And I think that we need that story on record.
So I will tell that story again. So you would ask me if I had taken Latin in high school, and I said that in high school they did not offer it, but a friend and I formed a Latin club, not so much to learn Latin, but because our school would give us candy to sell as a fundraiser for a group activity for having a club, and the two of us wanted to go to Cedar Point, which is an amusement park in Ohio. And so we formed the Latin Club specifically in order to get candy to sell for the two of us to go to Cedar Point. And we picked Latin because we figured no one else would want to join the club. Unfortunately, the teacher we had sponsoring the club figured out pretty quickly what we were up to, and the club was dissolved, and we did not go to Cedar Point.
So despite your checkered past, you have developed into a designer who makes lots of really cool games about ancient Rome. You both design your own and you publish others, but you have designed Agricola Master of Britain.
Mm-hmm.
You have an Aurelian game in that same system on the way. I know that you've designed, is it Optimates and Populares?
Yes.
And don't you also have like a Roman battle game in development?
Yes, that's called The Grass Crown. And that's going to be the second game in our Shields and Swords Ancients series, which is, in turn, a spinoff of our Shields and Swords series of medieval games.
So as someone who has designed several games about Rome and the ancient world, what is the attraction for you? What is it that pulls you to make multiple games about Rome?
I don't know, there's a lot that's fascinating about Rome and about the Romans. You know, there's some aspects of the culture that seem quite alien today, and then some that seem very resonant. I mean, one thing with the political game I did, Optimates et Populares, is that while it was very much about the politics breaking down during the Roman Republic, the dynamics involved are dynamics that you can see all throughout human political history, right up to the present day. You know, that elemental human thing never really changes. That was one that attracts me to it, you know, because it's human history, it's human beings, and then human beings in all their glory and ridiculousness is always appealing. Plus they got cool outfits. Those are fun. And you have so many different stories that are possible on such a large scale, both geographically and time-wise. So, that's all stuff that's appealing about the Romans. And they also, from watching several documentaries, I know they all had British accents, and that's cool, too.
Yes, the British accent of epicness. If you don't have it, are you a real Roman? So the other thing I think is interesting, if I recall correctly, Optimates and Populares is both a game in itself, and you use that system and applied what you had modeled about Roman politics to a more modern era.
Yes. So some of the essential mechanical building blocks of Optimize That Popularis found its way into my game This Guilty Land, which was about politics in America in the antebellum period. Those are very different games. They feel very different. The Roman game is actually fairly abstract and almost deterministic. There's a bit of a random setup within the game, and there's one action which you may or may not use that uses a die roll. Everything else is completely combinatorial. And I think that's actually one of probably the flaws with that game. Because while I'm proud of the game and I'm proud of the systems and the way they work, at the same time, that's a game about the breakdown of the Roman Republic, and it doesn't feel particularly chaotic or dangerous the way that it should. It feels very ordered. And so when I was, after having released that game, gotten feedback on that game, and when I was starting to think about tackling This Guilty Land, I one of the primary things I looked at was, okay, how do I more fully evoke the feel of the period? Not just modeling, you know, this particular political system or the way public opinion shifts, but how do I evoke the feel of the thing? Because the feel of the thing is tremendously important. And that's what led to This Guilty Land having there's a fair amount of randomness in the system, a lot of variability, a lot of swinginess that works really well for that period, and probably would have worked really well for the Roman game if I had thought of that at that time, you know. But I didn't, so.
So you talk about designing games that are meant to evoke specific feelings. And, you know, in this particular setup, you're talking about chaos. What kinds of feelings are you trying to bring out with This Guilty Land, which, of course, is a game that it's more timely now, perhaps, than it ever has been?
So I think one of the primary things with This Guilty Land is I wanted to ask questions about complicity and the complicity of silence and moderation. And I wanted to create space for people to do that. So in case your listeners are unfamiliar, this is a game in which one player represents the idea of justice, which is trying to end and abolish slavery. And the other player is representing the position of oppression, which is working against that. And then there's a third non-player faction, Compromise. And I try to be very careful not to have players identify with a faction, not to have them, you know, walk a mile in those shoes. Because, first of all, I don't think it's particularly useful or interesting to see the world through the eyes of people who perpetrated slavery. Like, there's not much to learn there, I don't think. I don't really want to show both sides of that. But the other thing is I wanted to create space, create distance, so that players could observe the model and observe how this third faction, Compromise, even though it's trying not to take a stand and trying just to keep peace, inevitably is benefiting oppression and benefiting systems of oppression. So I wanted to create space for people to reflect on that and reflect on their own complicity and what's going on today. And, you know, am I as a person doing enough today? Am I speaking up enough today? And so that was the kind of thing I wanted to evoke, as well as just maybe just a feeling of anger, because really, this is something that I get into more in the playbook that comes with the game. The arguments used by the oppression side in the game, these are the same arguments we're having today about different issues, but the same bad faith, pseudo-intellectual arguments that we've always had, and maybe always will have. I hope not. So trying to hold up that mirror to a degree without making it, you know, a metaphor or allegory for now, but to show where now and then kind of overlap and resonate.
I like that comment that you just made about now and then overlapping, resonating, about the connection between past and present. Is that something that you are seeking in all of your historical games? You have quite a range.
Yeah, to a degree. I mean, I think some of my work is more seriously minded than others. You know, if I'm doing a game about this particular battle or series of battles, you know, I'm not going to say that that game is really going to provoke reflections on what's going on right now. But other games that are less about, you know, kinetic warfare and more about political and sociological conflict, I think it is important to realize that any act of history is about two times. It's about the time in which it happened and the time in which you are telling it. So in order to engage with history in a useful way, you do have to be aware and present of the present. And one thing I try to be clear about, which I think it's lost sometimes, because a lot of war game designers and publishers, you know, they'll say, you know, I'm a historian or I'm an amateur historian. I'm not a historian, really. I'm not trying to make a history thing. I'm trying to make a kind of art object. I don't mean art like capital A art. This is artsy fartsy art. I just mean I'm trying to make something that makes an argument about history, using history, engaging with history. And that argument might not be I'm not being objective. I don't need to be objective. I sometimes refer to myself as more making agitprop, and I wish I had a better word for it, because it is a kind of a loaded word, especially with you know, Soviet connotations. But I'm making some kind of artwork that is meant to provoke emotion and thought and make an argument, sometimes a very political argument, and sometimes evoke very political anger.
So I do consider myself a historian, and I would say that what you are doing is within the essential work of what good historians do. I mean, okay. History, you know, you can look up a date anywhere, right?
Yeah.
But what are you going to do with the history that you know? So I like that you have brought this around to art, because the thing that actually inspired me to contact you about coming on was that you tweeted recently, games are art. If art can't grapple with things that are important, then what the hell is it for? Would it really be so bad if your games were capital A art? What's the difference for you? What's the discomfort with that?
The discomfort with me myself calling something I did capital A art is that it is pretentious, and I'm not the one who gets to make that judgment call. So I think it really comes to that. It's not my place to say how successful it is or how artistic it is or how important it is or whatever. I can try to do something that's important, something that matters to me, but whether or not other people see it that way, that's up to those other people.
Are there board games that you did not design that you consider to be art? And what is it that makes them art as opposed to entertainment?
Well, I think the thing here is that my definition of art, and again, staying away from the capital A art as a value judgment thing, more just an art in general definition of art, is pretty broad, where any game is a work of art. It is an artwork. It might not be a good one. It might not be a useful one. It might not be a moral one, but it is an art product, artwork. It falls under the purview of art for me. Just the same as any movie, any book, any TV show, even any television advertisement. It might not be a form of art I have a lot of affection or use for, but I would say, yes, that is a type of art. I know Scott McCloud, the comic book guy, he did a book called Understanding Comics, and he argued that anything that didn't have to do with survival or reproduction constituted art. And I'm not sure if I go quite that broad with it, but generally in anything we do to express anything, especially something that's not necessarily utilitarian, I would call that art.
I like that definition, actually. It actually really strikes me. When I first started writing about board games, nobody read my blog. Probably nobody does. But but one week I checked my view count and I was so excited because, you know, more than like two people had read my blog. And one of my colleagues was in the room and she said, "Liz, why don't you write about something important? Why are you writing about games?" And I think for me, it does come down to the fact that I do think that games are important. Is that something that's true for you also?
Yeah. I mean, is it the most important thing in the world? No, but it does have importance. I mean, one thing games can do is it can bring people together. One thing games can do is it can create a space to reflect on things. I think one thing games can do that other forms can't do as well is because games literalize everything, you can take things that are kind of intangible and invisible, like systemic factors, and you can make them very concrete, and you can observe systems at work with a transparency you don't get, say, with a video game, because it's all there. You can see how it works, you see how the machine's put together, and you can observe how these forces or factors impact the game state, and then you can extrapolate that's how these forces or factors impact human lives. Humans are very, very good at anecdotal evidence, at stories about people, but it's harder to see the big systemic picture when you have systemic factors in a society, right? So games, I think, can be tremendously useful and important in demonstrating that. Now, there are hurdles there, of course, as well, because games, board games are generally a luxury object. They're not inexpensive. And there's certain restraints on the ability of games to be accessible to a wider audience. And audience without the kind of income, without the kind of free time to actually get into games. I mean, I would say, you know, This Guilty Land is the game I'm proudest of, and I'm very proud of the argument it makes and how it makes it. But at the same time, that's an argument that's going to be most likely to be experienced by someone who is already well-versed in games, how to play modern games. And, you know, that's not going to be as accessible to Joe Q public out in the street, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I think, I really do honestly think that the most important work in games is yet to come. And I think it will be finding out how to express this systemic stuff so people are more aware of systemic problems and issues, and less focused on the anecdotal cases.
Interesting. So I know that one of your upcoming releases is going to be a game that is about women's suffrage. How do the issues we talked about in terms of systemic problems appear in that game?
That's a good question. So, for one thing, with This Guilty Land, it was showing these particular ways that we try to solve problems in society not working. And in The Vote, is showing those problems, the solutions rather, at work, but in both directions. So it's showing how you can enact meaningful change through legislative means, through public discourse. But it's also showing how those same tools can be used to oppose meaningful change, and how, you know, certain systems are set up to perpetuate certain levels of power, and privilege and power being concentrated in certain hands. And it's very hard to kind of wrest control of that away from it. And also that even when you make these advances, right, the victory, as it were, is still incomplete, because the game, so the game has one player pursuing the 17th and 19th Amendments to the U.S. Constitution, one of which made the Senate more democratic, where senators would actually be elected instead of just appointed. And how that basically got passed, because, you know, senators didn't particularly want that, but how that got passed is at the local level, at the state level, enough states passed laws making their senators work that way, that they had enough control of the Senate where they then could push that through and then push it out as an amendment to the rest of the country. And so it's kind of a workaround. But really, if it was a just society, as it were, there wouldn't have been need for that. It would have been very obvious, okay, we need to not have this. This is not responsive. This is not democratic. We need to change this. So getting through that legal system to change that from the ground up, you know, it was a long and involved process. And similar situation with the 19th Amendment. So one player is doing that, and then the other player is trying to oppose them, but is also passing laws and such to suppress votes. Is also passing laws and stuff to suppress votes. And at the end of the game, even if you pass the 19th Amendment and you've gotten the right to vote, theoretically for everyone, it's not really for everyone, because you still have the Jim Crow laws in the South. You still have a number of people who aren't even considered citizens and aren't allowed to vote. And that's just kind of hinting at how this, you know, the system is still in place. So working within the system, you still have people who are left behind. And it's trying to, you know, provoke thought about that and trying to demonstrate that and demonstrate the ways these tools that are used to advance, that can be used to correct things, also can be used to roll them back. A particular card that's really annoying in the game is a Supreme Court's card that undoes state-level laws. Because generally, all throughout this period especially, the Supreme Court and the national legislature, they were not on the right side of these issues and would consistently rule to roll things back or cancel things or just make them difficult. So it's just showing that, you know, obstructionism is a long-standing American tradition, and that is also, I think, opposed to the stories that we Americans tell ourselves about ourselves.
Oh, that's a good way to word it. So I like what you are saying about games having the ability to help us see systems in ways that stories are unable to. However, do you think that showing that much of the system affects the ways that games are able to emotionally impact the people who play them? Can a game be as much of a gut punch as a very well-written novel? Or do games have a different purpose in terms of the kinds of stories they tell?
I think it's a different purpose and a different kind of gut punch, as it were. You know, I one reason why I kind of advocate for a systemic approach is because a lot of people talking about, you know, about advancing the form of board games, they tend to revolve around, you know, the more emotional and narratively emotional questions of, you know, when am I going to cry because my meeple, you know, died? When, you know, and I there is some very interesting work being done in that sort of vein, as far as creating a narrative emotional response in games. I just don't think it's kind of native to the art form. And I think a lot of times when the question comes up, it comes up in a way that, to me, can often be used to denigrate the art form. The example I like to come back to is William Shakespeare. You may have heard of him. He wrote some plays, and some of those plays have been adapted for ballet and for opera. And the thing about a Shakespeare play that's been a play and a ballet and an opera is that you don't walk out of the opera saying, well, you know, the play was better, because they're different forms with different capabilities and different things that they're able to do. So I think the gut punch from games for me, it's less about being involved on a personal narrative level with, say, a character the way you would with a novel or a film, mm-hmm. and more creating space for reflection. But I also know there's a lot of people who feel, you know, very differently than that. So, I mean, that's the great thing about it, too, is that, you know, we're not all going to agree on it, right? There's so many different points of view, and they're all valid.
Absolutely. I guess the other question that comes to me from this conversation is, so when we talk about accessibility, it is true that as objects, games are luxury objects, but do you also think that they take more work to appreciate as art? Because, I mean, even if you know nothing about music, you can listen to music. Even if you have never read, I don't know, capital L literature before, I have my own thoughts about all that. Most people are trained to read, so you could literally just go read a book. But is it really even possible to just go play a game at this point? Especially games that are very deep into kind of hobbyist ways of rules writing and mechanism choice. You know, how can we make gaming more accessible as an art form, or can we?
That's a very good question that I you know, if I had the answer for that, boy, we'd be selling lots of games. and it's one that, I think it's one that's worth grappling with, but I you know, I don't have any particular insight into that one. I am, you know, people do bring up, you know, when you play a video game, you have the tutorial, and it teaches you to play the game as you play it. And because you have this limited controller, it's, you know, it's more intuitive in that way. But at the same time, you know, people say, well, you know, could we do this for games? And there have been some games that have experimented with doing something like that. But if someone can crack that code, I mean, that's kind of like a holy grail kind of thing. At the same time, I remember when I first started playing video games, we didn't have a tutorial. We had an instruction booklet.
Oh, I remember those.
You know, and sometimes they're very thick instruction booklets. You know, I remember the instruction book for Legend of Zelda and for Final Fantasy, and it was kind of immersive in a way. And I think video games got more accessible as they got away from that. I don't know how to do that with board games. And part of that, too, is that, you know, board games have been around longer than almost any other art form. I mean, there's always been music, right? But
yeah,
thousands of years, people have been playing board games. Some version of backgammon was being played in ancient Rome.
Absolutely. And that's a society where only about 10% of people could read. But you can mm-hmm. look at the steps in the forum or beside the bath at a bathhouse, and somebody has carved a game board into the stone. More people knew how to game than they did how to read at that time.
And of course, that's a very simple game. Now, the games have gotten more complicated, obviously. But it's a tricky question. I'm not sure what the answer is. Now, for me, you know, most of my games are pretty simple mechanically. And most of it's because I do a lot of games. And I want to be able to remember the rules mostly. So I made them simple enough where I can remember the rules most of the time. I still got to look up rules when I get rules questions. But, you know, so someone's asking about a game that came out 2-3 years ago. Well, you know, we've released 40 games since then. So it's...
Yeah, that does happen to me too. I've definitely had a 2-year-old YouTube video and somebody would be asking about a specific rule. I don't know. I don't know anymore. The other thing I think might affect games and their accessibility honestly, is the way that socially we are now, you have to, I mean, I'm a solo gamer, which eliminates a lot of these problems for me. I can enjoy games on my own as a personal experience because that's typically what I do. I love to play solo. But, you know, when I'm playing with a game group, I love my game group, but they always want to play something new. You know, I just got a Gloomhaven Jaws of the Lion, and it's the first 5 scenarios are tutorial. And I actually think that that is wonderful, but I also think, who's going to commit to that? Does it still take a special person to commit to that? And I think that there's an extra layer if it's something that is a historical game. So I was telling you before we started recording, I'd really love to play The Field of the Cloth of Gold, but I also think that that game would shine the best with a partner who wants to have that same kind of sly, catty experience with me, as opposed to somebody who just wants to try a game.
Yeah.
Is there any way that you can prepare people for the emotional experiences of your games to make sure that it's a selling point, not a surprise?
Oh, boy. I mean, one thing that we tried to do within the rule books and also within what could laughably be called our marketing is we tried to emphasize what experience the game is providing and who might like it and who might not like it. One of our games that had kind of the most, I would say, controversial reception is a game called 4X, which is a game about trading currencies on the foreign exchange. And the back of the box is a long letter in which we are explaining why they shouldn't buy the game. And we are being very serious because this is a very niche game. It's for very particular tastes. And there's a good chance that if you buy it, you're the only one in your group who's going to like it. And we try to emphasize this. And unfortunately, everyone kind of read that and said, oh, that sounds great. And a lot of people bought it who it turns out, it did not resonate with. And that was kind of the problem there. We're kind of blessed, Mary and I, in that our games are so niche and they're produced for a very niche audience who kind of are going to meet us halfway most of the time. They're not usually going to try to get, you know, their random person from game night to play our weirdness with them. So they're going to be people who are looking for that kind of offbeat, idiosyncratic, sometimes, you know, aggressively experimental approach. But we try to be very clear about that, especially because we don't want, like, I don't want a bunch of people who aren't going to dig it to plop down cash for it. I mean, I don't mind the cash, but at the same time, I'd rather they be happy with the purchase, be a game that's right for them. So we try to be very careful to kind of point out what could turn you off of a game.
So we talked a lot about, you know, difficult concepts in games, games that are for niche audiences, games as art. And, you know, I think we also need to talk about the other side of art. So perhaps you could tell me about the artistic significance of Dinosaur Table Battles, which is another of your recent releases.
The artistic significance of Dinosaur Table Battles. For me, the artistic significance of that is that Mary asked me to make it, and I love her, so I made it for her. Like, in a way, I mean, it's done very well. People seem to really enjoy it, and it sold very well. But in a way, it essentially was a rather expensive gift for my wife. So that's kind of all the. I mean, so for me, I can't really conceive of it beyond, you know, if it has anything really to say. It's fun, and it's okay sometimes to just do things that are fun. Because if I did games that were just like serious message games all the time, I would be so bummed out. I would be so drained and so depressed. You know, I have like over 50 games out there with my name on it that I've designed. And some of them are these very serious games. Some are very experimental and aggressively weird. And some of them are just kind of normal games, normal Hex Encounter war games, or a kind of normal dinosaurs fighting each other game. Because otherwise I'd go nuts, you know?
That was such an endearing and earnest answer to a question that I totally asked with a big smile on my face. I love it so much. But yeah, I actually like where you went with that. And it was where I was hoping to go, which is that, you know, sometimes a game really can be just a game. And it can just be silly. And it can just be play. I did want to ask, you know, in the midst of so many serious games, they are still games. So how do you find that spirit of a good time in the midst of so many quirky and serious designs?
I mean, there are games that are designed to be a good time, and the games that are designed not necessarily to be a bad time, but, you know, to be interesting and to be thought-provoking. The same way with, you know, say a movie. You know, I mean, there are movies that are just, you know, pure pleasure. And then there are movies that are very serious, and some are a little too serious. But, you know, it doesn't mean that I think that's valid. And I think especially as far as games as an art form, I think that's valid to have some games that are more frivolous and some games that are much less so. I think where people kind of butt up against games as art and kind of object to it, is there are people who feel that games must always be fun, must always be frivolous, and that if a game wasn't that, well, what are you doing? Why is that a game? And, you know, I think that's just, I mean, that's a point of view. They're entitled to it. I don't agree with it, and I don't know how to convince them that they're wrong, you know, because for them, that's what the game is. There are a lot of people for whom games are just the mechanics, or just a mathematical puzzle. And it's fun for them to have that. And so the idea of a game having a theme and coming out of that theme is anathema to them. I remember when we announced this Guilty Land, there were people, like Eurogamers, who thought that we came up with these mechanisms, and then we slapped this theme on it to be provocative. And they could not understand that the mechanisms came out of the theme, and that the theme and the argument and the story it was trying to tell through those mechanisms was the point of the thing. Because for them, that's not what games are. And it's unusual, I think, in a way, because, you know, there are people I know who, you know, they go to see the movies, and they're only going to go see, you know, kind of the light, frivolous stuff. They're gonna stay away from serious and art house stuff. But they know the art house stuff exists, and they don't think of it as being, like, posturing. It's just they know it's not for them, right?
Right.
Whereas with games, we tend to run to more people where they think trying to make any kind of statement or something where the theme matters is lying or posturing. And, you know, I don't get it.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons I've gravitated more towards historical games in the last couple of years is that, for me, that extra, I don't know, intellectual and emotional kick I get out of games that are really trying to say something adds a lot to my experience of the game. And it makes me think about games in newer ways and in ways that keep me coming back to the hobby again and again, because it's always got something fresh to tell me. But I'm going to let you go shortly, but one more question before I ask people where they can find you on the internet, which is, what is the most pure fun that you have ever had with a game? We've talked serious stuff, so let's just talk something light. The most silly, exalted fun.
There's a game that I love. Mary doesn't love it as much. Which is called High Society by Ryder Kinesia. And for me, I remember games of that where it's just such a nutty experience, and it's just fun and silly and crazy. And I can't tell you the story of this time or that time right at the top of my head right now, but that's a game that for me is a very interesting game. it's very interesting as a design and very interesting as far as player dynamics. And then it's just kind of crazy fun. And it's a great way to unwind, I think.
So thank you so much, by the way, for the time that you've spent with me. Do you have any final thoughts before you tell us where we can find you online?
No, I don't have any final thoughts, really. It's been great talking with you and having this conversation. As far as finding us online, well, our website is www.hollandspiel.com. That's where we sell our games. We're on the Twitter. There's the @Hollandspiel account, which mostly is Mary running that. And then the @TomandMary account, which these days is mostly me running that. And I think that about covers it.
Awesome. And as y'all know, you can find me anywhere as Beyond Solitaire. Thank you so much for listening, everyone. Come back again next week, and happy gaming.